So if given the choice, I'll choose not to cry about something. And I'm probably not alone in that. See, I'll be honest, I'm not into suffering. I don't like it. I'm trying my hand. By the way, God bless, are there any bricklayers out there? Because God bless you guys and gals, if there's any, because I'm trying my hand, and I banged my finger yesterday trying to tap bricks into place. I'm just building a fire pit, by the way. Incidentally, you don't want me building your house. I'll say that. And I banged my finger, and I'm like, I hate it. I don't like to suffer. I don't like to feel pain. I like to be comfortable. And yet, we're not commanded to make ourselves comfortable. The scriptures are very explicit in what the Apostle Paul said through God. I'm sorry, what God said through the Apostle Paul. Let me get that right. Romans 12:15, rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. But let's face it, who wants to weep? Furthermore, who wants to rejoice over something that perhaps, if you're going to be honest, you're a little bit jealous about? I was reading something from a writer, a teacher named Stanley Hauerwas. He was talking about suffering. He said, there's this sense of wanting to avoid suffering, deal with it by casting it out of our lives. We want to exert some kind of control, he says. We want to be more comfortable, avoid suffering entirely if we can. This will often mean marginalizing or shifting scenes of suffering off to the sidelines. Turn a blind eye. He goes on to say that he thinks suffering has become an anomaly in America, that we assume always legitimizes trying to get rid of suffering altogether. And that turns out to be a formula for death and leads us to things like abortion. By the way, anytime I mention abortion, I want to also mention it is not an unforgivable sin. Because in the name of compassion, we're living in a social order that will increasingly not know what to do with those children who are born dying. So he goes on, here's another quote. A social order bent on producing wealth as an end in itself cannot avoid the creation of a people who, listen to this, whose souls are superficial and whose daily life is captured by sentimentalities. That's a fancy word for just pointlessness. They will ask questions like, why does a good God let bad things happen to good people? We're a society that says it's okay to abort children if they hinder our lives. We avoid people who don't further our social media feeds or give us a sense of importance. Or maybe you've experienced something called Schadenfreude. You know what Schadenfreude is? I'll give you the definition. The experience of pleasure or joy or self-satisfaction that comes from learning of or witnessing the troubles, failures, pain, or humiliation of another. That one's harder to admit. What I want to talk about this morning is why must we as Christians share in the suffering of others? Why is it that it's commanded of us to share in the sufferings that other people are going through? Many times you'll perhaps avoid the person that you know is grieving because you don't know what to say. You'll avoid the person who's hurting because you don't want to go there. Maybe you've got your own pains and problems, and for that reason, you'll avoid others with pain or problems. We'll find something very opposite in the text today. This morning will be in Genesis chapter 45. Genesis 45, we'll start with verse 1, and we'll make our way down through verse 28. Genesis 45, 1 through 28. I'm going to read those verses. Again, I'll ask you to stand with me. If you get too tired, it's a long reading, feel free to sit down. For others of you, please stand with me for the reading of Genesis chapter 45, starting at verse 1 and reading down through verse 28. Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and he wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. So Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near, and he said, "I am your brother, Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest, and God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father, and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children, and your children's children, and your flocks, your herds, and all that you have. There I will provide for you. For there are yet 5 years of famine to come, so that you and your household and all that you have do not come to poverty. And now your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see, that it is my mouth that speaks to you. You must tell my father of all my honor in Egypt, and of all that you have seen. Hurry and bring my father down here. Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. And Benjamin wept upon his neck, and he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. After that, his brothers talked with him. When the report was heard in Pharaoh's house, Joseph's brothers have come. It pleased Pharaoh and his servants. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, say to your brothers, do this, load your beasts and go back to the land of Canaan. And take your father and your households and come to me, and I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you shall eat the fat of the land. And you, Joseph, are commanded to say, do this. Take wagons from the land of Egypt for your little ones and for your wives, and bring your father and come. Have no concern for your goods, for the best of all the land of Egypt is yours. The sons of Israel did so, and Joseph gave them wagons according to the command of Pharaoh and gave them provisions for the journey. To each and all of them he gave a change of clothes, but to Benjamin he gave 300 shekels of silver and 5 changes of clothes. To his father he sent as follows, 10 donkeys loaded with the good of things of Egypt, and 10 female donkeys loaded with grain, bread, and provision for his father on the journey. Then he sent his brothers away, and as they departed, he said to them, do not quarrel on the way. So they went up out of Egypt and came to the land of Canaan to their father Jacob. And they told him, Joseph is still alive, and he is ruler over all the land of Egypt. And his heart became numb, for he did not believe them. But when they told him all the words of Joseph, which he had said to them, and when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. And Israel said, it is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die. You may be seated. We're coming down to the end of the book of Genesis, and the book of Genesis that explains to us that God is choosing this group of people, this line of Abraham. He's going to bless them. He's going to raise them up. Through him, he's going to show the entire world his generosity, how much he loves mankind. He's seeking to draw in peoples of the earth. Then we come to the New Testament. The command is different. Jesus said, go out, you Christians, go out. And if need be, lay down your lives and suffer for the cause that I'm giving you. And that will be, ironically, even paradoxically, a pathway to peace and joy as you suffer for the cause of Christ. Sometimes God calls us not to just suffer on our own, but to come alongside and suffer with a brother or a sister of the faith. We're going to see that this morning, why we must often suffer with someone else. I want to approach that subject this way. What do we receive when we suffer with others? How do we receive it? And finally, why do we share in the suffering? What do we receive as we suffer with others? How do we receive it? And then finally, why do we share in the suffering? So, we come into the text today. First of all, what do we receive when we share in the suffering of others? I want to be very clear at the get-go. Well, we receive divine blessing from God. Now, what is that? What does that mean? Well, stay tuned. We're going to start with the good news of this text. We're looking at two chapters. We'll look at 44 and 45. 45, we get to see the blessed reunion. We get the good news. Then we'll go back and look what led up to it. But by the time we get to verse 9 in chapter 45, we see this divine overflow of blessing. God is doing exactly what he promised to do, that he would bless all the peoples of the world through the line of Abraham. And they've acknowledged all through this text of what is happening is from the Lord. This is after tears were shed. The giant reveal has happened. Joseph told his brothers who he is, and the reunion is underway. Joseph says, go get dad. Hurry to Egypt. We'll all dwell here. All your families, all your kids, all your granddads, all the grandkids, all the flocks, all the herds. All of us are going to dwell here together. You get down to verses 14 and 15. He fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck. And he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. After that, his brothers talked with him. Now, those brothers, and we'll go back and walk through all that they've experienced, but they're hearing this tremendously good news. Their brother, who thought they had that had been abandoned, for all they knew he was dead, has now become the number two guy in all of Egypt, and he's telling them all these wonderful things that's going to happen to them that they absolutely don't deserve. They're just happy he's not exacting revenge on them. But they also recognize, okay, what this almost sounds too good to be true. You're the number two guy in all of Egypt. Well, what does the number one guy, the Pharaoh, say? It says Pharaoh finds out. He's pleased of the news of Joseph's brothers. He provides the animals that's going to carry all their goods from Canaan back to Egypt. He'll give them the best of the land. You're not going to live in some ghetto in Egypt, he says. You're going to live in the best part of Egypt, and assures them they'll have more than they'll ever need when they get back. The brothers have to make their way back to the land of Canaan as they're leaving. Joseph gives them these parting words. Don't quarrel among yourselves. He says, I know you people. You're going to leave here. You're going to get to fighting with each other. He said, don't do it. Don't start blaming each other about who did or who didn't sell me into slavery. Don't worry about it. Don't quarrel. You're forgiven. Now, he knew what they had to do next. It's going to be one of the hardest things the brothers had to do. They had to go back, and their father's going to have to know how this all came about. They're going to tell him what happened, that his son's alive. Jacob's response on hearing the incredibly good news, though, is very similar to the disciples when they find out that Jesus is alive. Having been raised from the dead, the great news at first was stunned disbelief and then unspeakable joy. The text says his heart became numb at first. For all these years, he thought his son was dead. Now he's revived, he's reoriented, his dead son is back, his lost son Simeon will be returned. Think about that. They have gone through decades of pain and estrangement, the brothers with guilt over what happened to their brother, the father thinking his son was dead. And all of a sudden, they get it all back and then some. All of a sudden, they get the holiday dinners back. They can play cards together in the evenings. They can do things that we see in those Norman Rockwell paintings. And maybe you came from a family where you still get to do those things. And maybe you came from a family where you always wanted those things and you can't have them, or maybe you've lost them somewhere along the way. But now they've got it back. And now, interestingly, that the family, the brothers, are back together with their dad, now they're about to become pilgrims. Pilgrims. This is an interesting word. Pilgrims that are leaving the land plagued with famine, headed to the best place imaginable, going from the land of the dying to the land of the living. And in the last verse of this chapter, Jacob is labeled Israel. He didn't care about the fortune or the wagons or the goodies or the land of Egypt. He only says in verse 28, it is enough Joseph, my son is still alive. I will go and see him before I die. Now you and I can start to see ourselves a bit in this narrative, because you and I see we're also pilgrims. They were pilgrims on their way from the land of the dying to the land of the living. You and I, we're also pilgrims. Guess what? From the land of the dying, headed toward the land of the living, going from the place that is dying to the place where all of our joys, all of our hopes and desires will ultimately be realized if you've put your faith in Jesus Christ. You're headed to that heavenly city. Joseph's family was God's family. They're willing to weep together. It said that Joseph and his brothers, they wept together. They'll go and get to enjoy divine blessings together. This was a family that is now enjoying these divine blessings. They'll pilgrim their way to Egypt. I love what Warren Wiersbe said when he was describing what a pilgrim is. He said, a fugitive is fleeing from home. A vagabond has no home. A stranger is away from home. But listen to this. But a pilgrim is heading home. Now see, this is the blessing that you and I get to enjoy as well. That when we get to be part of this family of God, when one part hurts, the other part hurts. Being part of a loving Christian fellowship and family, it's what we are. Now let me ask you, isn't that what you want to be part of? Is a family that cares about each other, that shares each other's hopes and hurts? By the way, do you think the world out there wants to be part of that too? That there's souls out there in Sheridan that are hurting, that want to be part of a loving family, that never gotten to be part of one before, and many of us can testify firsthand when we look back at seasons of intense grief. We don't remember what people told us, but we remember who was there, don't we? There's people that showed up, the people that sat with us when we were in tears. That's a family. We're all fellow pilgrims, leaving the land of the dying, headed to the hand of the living. By the way, that's why we have life groups. That's why we call them life groups, because that's where life is happening. You know, in here, there's only so much we can do in an auditorium. You're sitting shoulder to shoulder with people. There's probably someone sitting maybe in front of you or behind you that you don't know. Chances are you're not going to be able to open up here like perhaps you would like to open up to share your hurts with someone like you'd like to share your hurts. That's why we need smaller groups of people sharing lives together, prayer requests, the good stuff, the bad stuff. But we're called to be thoughtful. We're called to be compassionate, to help each other, lend a helping hand, a shoulder to cry on. Christians looking to comfort the sad. That's a blessing. It's a blessing when we get to sit with someone who's suffering. You know, it's hard for me to be with someone who has never known any suffering. I always learn from those who have suffered in this life. We're called to be with the sufferers. That's what we receive from God. Divine blessing, being part of a family of God, leaning on each other, loving each other, this kind of fellowship. And if you don't have that fellowship, your life is missing something. And you're depriving other people from your presence. So how do we receive that kind of blessing? How do we receive it? How do we receive that kind of fellowship? Well, you got to be willing to stand with the sufferers. You've got to be willing to join in on the suffering. Let's get back to our text. Two men in this section are willing to make very sacrificial stances. I want to go back now to chapter 44. At the beginning of chapter 44, all seems well. If you remember, at the end of 43, the brothers have passed their test. They were accused of being spies and all this, and they come back. They bring their brother Benjamin, and they show, hey, we're not spies. We brought our brother, and they have a big feast together, and all seems well. All seems like the test has been passed, but there's still an ultimate final they have yet to take. They depart Egypt with full sacks of food with Benjamin, but this is what happened. Joseph cleverly placed a silver cup into Benjamin's sack as they were leaving. He told one of his servants, after they leave, run up to them, and here's what you're going to say. So the servant leaves, runs up to the men, their caravan, catches up with them, and he says exactly what Joseph said. He said, one of you has stolen a cup from Joseph, a special cup, a silver cup. The brothers insist, look, if any of us have stolen a cup, take their life. They were just positive nobody had it. So go ahead and take the life of the person that has it. They start searching through the sacks. They go from oldest to youngest. They let the tension build in the narrative. Finally, they get to Benjamin's sack. They open it up, and they find the silver cup. Now, here's the test. The brothers have their money. They have their food. Now it's daddy's favorite son again. Who's got the silver cup in the bag? How do they feel about daddy's favorite? The unjust, by the way, it's never a good idea to have a favorite child. Don't do it. It's interesting that the cup is silver. If you recall, it was Joseph's brothers who betrayed him for silver. So, what's going to happen now? The brothers have everything. Will they abandon him to his death like they did Joseph? He took it. Go ahead, take him. It's his problem, not ours. Is that what they're going to do? What will they do? Look at verse 13. The cup is found. The brothers, then they tore their clothes, and every man loaded his donkey. What'd they do? They all headed back to Egypt. And notice it says, every man. But in the very next verse, it says, Judah and his brothers. There's a sign of Judah's leadership. He's starting to rise to the top. Now, they are operating with a sense of brotherly love here that they didn't have before. When they go back to Egypt, they all fall on the ground in front of Joseph. Nobody thinks of abandoning Benjamin. And Joseph still isn't convinced they've changed their attitudes. Okay, if they're going to do this maybe with Benjamin, what about their aging father? Back in Canaan, Joseph's going to put him through the ringer. He announces that only the guilty one will be his slave. They said, take his life. He said, just be my slave. So now what? Benjamin's going to be stuck there, enslaved in Egypt. Now they're supposed to all go back to their dad? Explain, hey, your favorite son is just gone again. That doesn't seem like a very good idea. So what does Judah do? He starts to give a speech. He starts to give a speech. He explains to Joseph, look at the whole situation here. Our father is old. He's already lost one son. It was his favorite son. Benjamin was the brother of that lost son. Interestingly, Judah calls Jacob his father 14 times. He calls him father in the remainder of this chapter. At the end of verse 16, Judah indicates, look, we're all guilty before God. God has found out the guilt of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's servants, both we and he also in whose hand the cup has been found. Look, we're all guilty. You may not know what we did. Now, he knew exactly what they did because he was the guy they did it to. But you may not know what we did, but God is calling out our guilt. And Joseph insists, no. The only the man who had the cup will be held accountable. And Judah, not letting his father's unjust favoritism even bother him, makes a long plea again, explains it would kill their father. So he begs Joseph, let me stay instead of Benjamin. Now think about this. At one time, Judah was all too willing to sell dad's favorite son right into slavery. And now all of a sudden, he's willing to take it on himself, to be selfless, to sacrifice himself instead of selling dad's favorite into slavery. He's gone from selfish to selfless, and he sets this powerful example. Joseph is also going to show his own selflessness and the forgiveness he's offering his brothers. He bursts into tears at this point. When he hears that speech of Judah, he can't stand it anymore. He reveals his identity. He forgives his brothers. This has been painted again and again. This is a mosaic from a 13th century church in Florence of that reunion. This is what it looks like to be the family through whom God will bless all mankind. These specifically in Judah. Judah is the ancestor of Jesus Christ himself. Judah, who chose to sacrifice himself but ultimately didn't have to, willing to put up his own freedom for the sake of his brother. See, you and I also, we have opportunities to both bless others and to be blessed. To be blessed, but then to bless someone else, to put into practice what we believe to be the way of Christ and selflessly serving others. Let me just ask you a few questions. Who in your life needs to have a phone call? Who in your life needs to have an arm put around them? Who in your life has maybe been suffering, you know, you just don't know quite what to say? Who in your life can you willingly sacrifice your own time or talent? Someone who can never pay it back. Who can you forgive? It was the willingness of those first disciples of Jesus Christ to go to their deaths. That still stands as one of the greatest testimonies to the truth of the resurrection of Christ, that those disciples of his, for the sake of those that would come after them, willingly laid down their lives to proclaim the resurrection of Jesus Christ with no regard to their own self-preservation. They were willing to die to get the message out. You may have heard of Augustine. He was one of the church fathers and came to Christ later in life. Brilliant man. It was his ambition to just live as a private person, focus on prayer, be contemplative. They recognized him as a good teacher. He became overseer of a lot of churches. Well, it came one day in 427 that there was going to be this invading group of Vandals into northern Africa where Augustine lived. So all of these refugees were coming in. They were sick refugees. And Augustine had to make a decision. Am I going to stay here with these people to whom I've been ministering so I don't get sick? Or am I going to stay here and love these people to whom God has placed me over to shepherd? They came in. A man named Genseric had laid siege to the city. He could flee. He felt like he had three choices. He said, well, I can flee, or I could stay holed up in my palace and ignore the needs of the people, but maybe preserve my own health. Or he thought, I could get my hands dirty and risk becoming ill myself. He said, I don't know how to be a bishop from afar. He stayed with the people, ended up getting the same sickness they had, and died not long after that. That man of God, we still read his books, gave his last hours ministering to the most basic needs of a frightened flock. And here's the paradoxical nature. You know, paradoxical means two truths that seem to be opposing each other, but are not. And the fact is, the more you focus on others, the more of a peace-filled, joyous life you're going to have. Do you know that? For the Christian, there's joy and peace in self-forgetting. And the more you focus on others, to do it to the point of it looks like sacrifice, the more you can disregard and forget about yourself, the more you can enjoy peace. I'm reminded of 1 Peter 4, 8-10. He said, above all, keep loving one another earnestly, since love covers a multitude of sins. Show hospitality to one another without grumbling. As each has received a gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. So quick recap, what do we receive? We receive this blessing from God. We receive the joy and peace our hearts are dying for. How do we get it? And there's the irony. You have to be willing to suffer with others. And then here's the big why. Why would we do all this? Why do we share in the sufferings of others? Well, namely because we recognize God's sovereignty in suffering. We recognize his sovereignty in suffering. All through this text, We see that these men, we see them, they understand that all that is happening here, even what's happening, what's being orchestrated on the human level, is happening because God is intending it to happen. You see, on two levels, what looks like the works of man, however, they're all saying that no, God is working through all this. By the way, God is always sovereign over the universe. I've often shared my definition of joy. I say it's mine. I owe this to Daniel Bistrom, that joy is the assurance that God is sovereign over all the universe. That joy is this deep and abiding assurance that God is sovereign over all the universe. Even though it looked like random acts of wickedness, it wasn't. Look at verse 5. What does Joseph say to his brothers? "And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." Joseph understands it's the hand of God in this that's working. He could be angry. He could be bitter. He could have these men killed. He chooses to do none of that. He could see the sovereignty of God at work. He could see the hand of God. And it's the sovereignty of God that allows you and I to live for others, to share in their suffering, because we see it is still the divine sovereignty of God that is allowing for human suffering, and He's working through it. It is the sovereign voice of God telling us to weep with those who weep. You know why so many of us feel self-conscious? If I just had the right friends, if I was just in the right social group, or, you know, I just hate those people that don't vote the way I do. I just hate them. I want nothing to do with them. There's a problem. Mainly, there's too many I's in those sentences. It's too much about me. All through there. C.S. Lewis, he said this in Mere Christianity. He made the observation about a gospel humility at the end of a chapter on pride. He said, if we were to meet a truly humble person, Lewis says, we would never come away from meeting them thinking we were humble. They were humble. They would not be always telling us they were a nobody. Because somebody who just says they're a nobody, he says, is a self-obsessed person. And in the book, The Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness, they go further discussing what Lewis is talking about here. The thing we would remember from meeting a truly gospel humble person is how much they seemed interested in us. Because the essence of gospel humility is not thinking more of myself or thinking less of myself. It's thinking of myself less. Gospel humility is not needing to think about myself, not needing to connect things with myself. It is an end to such thoughts as, I'm in this room with these people. Does that make me look good? Do I want to be here? True gospel humility means I stop connecting every experience, every conversation with myself. In fact, I stop thinking about myself altogether. The freedom of self-forgetfulness, the blessed rest that only self-forgetfulness brings. See, Christ is our ultimate example. And that He was willing to give up the glory of heaven. We'll have no idea what He gave up until we get there and we see it for ourselves. What He was willing to leave, to come to this earth, to take on sin, to become human, to die for us. So to put this all together, God's blessings overflow as we join in the suffering of others while recognizing God's sovereignty. God's blessing overflows as we join in the suffering of others while recognizing God's sovereignty. I want to close with this story of a woman willing to not only endure suffering, but to invite an interesting person into her own suffering as well. And besides the willingness of Christ's suffering, I can think of no better example than this South African woman. Her name was Kartala. And picture a South African woman in her 70s. She was frail. She was in a courtroom. In South Africa, the apartheid, the racism there against blacks was starting to subside. And they were having these courtroom meetings. There was an officer named Vandenbroek. He acknowledged his responsibility in the death of her son. Along with others, he had shot her 18-year-old son at point-blank range for being black.
He and the others partied while they burned his body, turning it over and over on the fire until it was reduced to ashes. 8 years after that, the same officer seized her husband. A few hours later, and this is hard to hear, shortly after midnight, the officer came to get the woman. He took her to a wood pile where her husband was tied up and bound, laying on that wood pile, forced her to watch as they poured gasoline over his body, ignited it with flames. The last words she heard her husband say were, "Forgive them." Now he's awaiting judgment, and she's there in this courtroom. This was part of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They asked her, "What do you want done to this man?" "I want three things," she said calmly. "First, I want this officer, Vandenbroek, to take me to the place where they burned my husband's body." She said, "I would like to gather up the dust and give him a decent burial." "Second, Mr. Vandenbroek took all my family away from me, and I still have a lot of love to give." She said, "Twice a month, I would like for him to come to the ghetto and spend a day with me so I can be a mother to him. Third, I would like Mr. Vandenbroek to know that he is forgiven by God and that I forgive him too. I would like someone to lead me to where he is seated so I can embrace him and he can know my forgiveness is real." They led her across that courtroom. The officer passed out. He fainted. He was overwhelmed. Somebody started singing "Amazing Grace" in the courtroom. Everybody joined in. How could Joseph lay it all aside and be reconciled to his brothers? How can this woman reconcile herself to the man that tortured and murdered her son and her husband? Because she understood that to be reconciled with God and to be reconciled with others is freedom. She wanted to be free of her hatred. She wanted to be free of what was keeping her up at night. She wanted to be free of any desire to exact vengeance on these people. I want to leave you with the words of 1 Peter 4:13. "But rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed." Let's pray together. Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. Amen. I want to thank you all so much for being here today. If you're in need of prayer, I would love to meet you down at the front. Otherwise, you have a wonderful day, and we'll see you soon. Thank you for being here this morning.